If your morning starts with snap, crackle, pop, and it's not your cereal, call Joint Relief Institute for fast-lasting joint pain relief. And yes, it's covered by Medicare. 708-888-0000.
Hi, I'm Paul Listick, and welcome to Behind the Curtain.
Super callous, fragile, egocentric, braggadocious, likes to throw big words around and hopes that we all notice. If he keeps repeating them, they might just make him POTUS. Super careless, fragile, ego, extra braggadocious. Are you really gonna vote for this guy?
Well, if you enjoyed that incredible piece of creative parody, there is so much more where that comes from. And if you're following this election season and you're getting a little tired of it or annoyed by it or aggravated with it, you can truly let off some steam by watching these really very funny and incredibly unique parodies created by Randy Rainbow. Randy, and that is his real name. Randy is a comedian. He has created truly an internet sensation with these parodies because he's getting, well, we'll let you tell him about it. He's hearing from all sorts of famous people about his work who are just really impressed in this election season. But he's known for doing so much more. We're going to tell you all about it right now. Randy, welcome to the podcast. Thanks for joining me.
Thank you so much for having me.
So I know, again, you're a comedian, so I get where the material comes from, but your parodies, I mean, you take, just in case listeners have not seen them, and I can tell them right now, they should go to therandyrainbowshow.com.
But actually, it's just randyrainbow.com.
Oh, randyrainbow.com, okay. Gotcha. Yeah. Sorry about that.
I'm also big on Facebook at Randy Rainbow Official, or follow me on Twitter at Randy Rainbow.
And we'll let you do that again before we're done. So when people check you out, you work after each debate, after each sort of famous, whatever it is that happens in this world. And then, of course, we go to, in my case, Facebook. Initially, I see your stuff on Facebook. And then there you are. And tell the listeners what it is you do to create these parodies, because it's not just you. You put yourself in the world of reality.
Yes. I'm sorry, what I do to create?
Well, what I mean is, yeah, how you go about and create these wonderful parodies, because you're using the reality of what happened, but then you show up.
Right. Well, I've sort of been using this, I guess, gimmick, technique, shtick, whatever you want to call it, for probably about 5 years now, where I've been inserting myself into pop culture and hot topics and stuff like that. I started with a video called Randy Rainbow is Dating Mel Gibson, when Mel Gibson had those horrible tapes released about 5 years ago.
Right.
Of his voicemails. I did a series of videos where I would interact with them as though I were talking to my boyfriend on the phone. So that kind of took off. And ever since then, I've been doing this. This has been my gimmick, so to speak. And it's certainly reached a new level with this election season.
So when you watch, say, a debate, as you've been working with each of the debates we've been seeing, and then within a couple of days we see your shtick about it.
Yeah.
And, of course, we can't play all of those because sometimes there's some foul language that shows up, although I think it's pretty funny the way you use it. But let me ask you, do you watch some of the Mel Gibson thing? It must have struck you this is something to work with. Now, because you're so known for what you do, do you sort of say, well, I'm clearly going to do something with this event, this debate that's going to happen. The question is what? Or are there things you might look at and pass on?
I do pass on certain things. I'm a quality versus quantity type of person. So I don't always, and that's sort of been a downfall of mine as a quote-unquote internet star sensation person, is that I'm not putting out content weekly. Luckily, in the past couple of months with the election, there has been stuff to cover that I've felt the itch to tackle pretty much every week or every day, with thanks to Trump. I don't cover absolutely everything. I just wait for the little tingle in my tummy.
And by the way, the election, it's hard to believe, but it actually will be over eventually.
I can't believe that.
I know. Do you keep yourself in the world of politics, or might we see you with Barbara Streisand? I mean, you know, are there limits to where you take this stuff, or have you gotten into this political thing so much with clearly you're making a niche for yourself as well?
Yeah, well, I'm kind of interested to see where I go after this election ends. I mean, I'll continue to tackle hot topics. I don't know how much I'll stay on politics. I don't know, but I certainly have grown my interest in politics. I'm not really like, I'm certainly not like a pundit or of any sort. I'm not a political, politically savvy that much. I'm pretty much, you know, just my, I think the stuff sort of delivers, the stuff that I do kind of delivers the message sort of in layman's terms, so to speak, which is part of what people like about it. So,
but, you know, maybe, maybe you don't intend it, but for example, in the vice presidential debate, I cover that here for WGN-TV, and right after the debate, my comments on air were all about how much Tim Kaine was interrupting Mike Pence. And of course, they were both doing it, but Tim Pence to a great degree. I mean, Tim Kaine to a great degree. And yet when your parody came out a couple of days, assuming you didn't watch my analysis or maybe every other analysis that was going on, you picked up on the same thing. I mean, we see that then in your parody.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I don't think that I saw anything about that. I think that that was just an obvious thing that was annoying the hell out of me. So that was an obvious direction to go in. But it is easier nowadays with Twitter and everything. And a lot of what I'll decide to do is based sort of on what's trending at the time. Or, you know, I don't really always like to go to what's most popular. I kind of like to go down my own path. But it does have, you can cheat a little bit. It's not, you know, you're not just wandering blind like you used to. You can go on Twitter and see what the phrase or what the moment of the event or the debate or whatever it was that everyone's talking about. So it does make it a little easier to find the direction.
I said when I introduced you, you're catching so much attention. Just tell my listeners a little bit about who are some of the people, maybe they surprised you, maybe they didn't, but I mean, we're talking about some big names who actually catch what you do and appreciate it.
Oh, my God, it's been so many, and I'm such a fan of everybody, so that's the most exciting part to me. You know, I mean, I do also stuff for Broadway a lot, so right. I've been hearing from a lot of my Broadway icons, like Audra McDonald and Alan Cumming and stuff like that, and what with this election stuff going on, it's sort of gone a little more mainstream, and I'm hearing from just, I mean, name it, everyone. Rosie O'Donnell, Harvey Fierstein, Mark Ruffalo, Leah Thompson. I'm trying to think who else.
Have you heard from any of the campaigns? Out of curiosity, have you heard from any of the campaigns? Anybody tied to Trump or to Clinton or any of those folks?
No, I think I have reason to believe that Hillary's camp knows me and enjoys me, but, you know, I don't know if they'll be inviting me to like the inauguration or anything.
Well, she may not
invite
you.
You know, with comedians, it's always a little iffy. They like to be a little careful, I think, with people who do comedy, which is understandable. But right. I would still like an invitation.
Well, I have a feeling that no matter who wins this election and who's giving that inaugural, I have a feeling within a couple of days of it, you actually will be at that inaugural, at least online.
What? By hook or by crook, I'll get there.
You may be holding the Bible, giving the oath. I have no idea where you're going to take it. But feel free to work me into it, too. I'm happy to stand right next to you while you're doing whatever you're doing.
Oh, you got it.
I love it. All right, Randy, tell everybody where they can find your stuff. Again, I'm not going to mess that up. So give all those places where people can find you and follow you.
Well, the easiest thing to do is just Google Randy Rainbow. I'm on Facebook at Randy Rainbow Official. I'm at Randy Rainbow on Twitter. And my website is randyrainbow.com.
That's perfect. And I said that is your real name, and it is your real name.
It is, because everyone thinks it's a stage name, but, I mean, if you think about it, it's the worst stage name that anyone could ever think of. And so, no, that is actually on my birth certificate. I would not choose it.
Well, I think it's a great name, and if you do a Judy Garland bit, you're all set to go.
Okay.
Randy, thank you so much. I appreciate it. Congratulations. I really do. Every time I see something new from you, I'm just boom. Turn it on. Time to watch it. It's great stuff. Thank you.
Thanks so much for having me, Paul. I hope we can talk again soon.
All right. Hope so, too. Be well.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Always time to touch base with where this election stands. And joining me, one of our favorite guests, Brad Bannon. He is the CEO, president of Bannon Communication Research, and also a Democratic strategist. So we get that bend from him, but always fair in trying to look at both sides to take a look at things. Brad, welcome back to the podcast.
Hey, Paul, how are you doing? Thanks for having me on the show again.
I am good. Now, always trying to keep these things, relevant and timely, but I think I have to sort of admit to the fact that we are doing this podcast a little before the debate begins, the third debate, final debate between the presidential candidates. So with that sort of out there in a candid way, let's talk about where things stand now. And as we get into that debate, and we'll do some predictions, but Hillary, I tell you, this email discussion won't go away. WikiLeaks, Julian Assange said we were going to get barraged every day with it, and he wasn't kidding. And every day, more fodder for discussion that just gives people concern about her trustworthiness.
Well, yeah, there you're right. There are email stories, courtesy of WikiLeaks, almost every day. And it is, it keeps the Clinton campaign on the defensive. You know, the reality is, I think I said this before to you before, if she was running against almost any other Republican than Donald Trump, she would be in big trouble. But she is running against Donald Trump, and that makes all the difference in the world.
Let's just take a focus for a little bit, because I think these leaks get very confusing. I mean, some of them are, I'm not going to say so into the weeds, but they are confusing, I think, for the average person to understand. And one of the latest pieces, this, we keep hearing this phrase, quid pro quo, was there a deal by somebody from the State Department to try and get the FBI to take an email that was confidential, or actually that was not confidential, and keep it from being made confidential, with apparently the offer of putting more FBI agents in areas they would otherwise not go, like Iraq. The FBI, the State Department saying that's not true. What are we to make of all of this? I know you're a Democratic strategist, but, you know, what do we make of this?
Well, I think it's very troubling if you read these emails, because sadly, I think the emails reflect how Washington works. And the reality is, watching Washington is like viewing sausage making. You really don't want to see the details. You just want to see the end product. And, you know, I think they're a reflection of how two things. First of all, how people do business in Washington, and B, why Americans are so upset about the way they do business in Washington, because it really these leaked emails really illustrate the darker side of American politics and government.
So you are a strategist. You work in campaigns. So probably an important question to ask you is, as you see these leaked emails from John Podesta, who apparently they got 10 years of his stuff, who was the head of Hillary's campaign, do you look at this and go, you know what, scary as it is, welcome to the world of elections? Is this just routine for what we would see if we looked at anybody's emails in any campaign?
Well, yeah, honestly, if you viewed, you know, I'm sure if you viewed Paul Ryan's emails, you probably see the same thing. You know, the thing about Washington is people make decisions based on, naked political calculations. And that's what you see in the Clinton emails, is basically before the Clinton campaign made any decision, they viewed the policy, they viewed the political aspects. And in Washington, and this is a sad reflection, there's a lot more emphasis on the politics of the situation than the policy of the situation. And again, I think this is one of the reasons why voters are so angry and upset with people in Washington, because this is basically business as usual.
So is Hillary Clinton as bad as these emails suggest she seems, that we, if she wins the election, we're putting in someone of just miserable character, or is she par for the course for what anybody? Would we find the same stuff if we went back and looked? Could we have the same feeling about even Barack Obama, who seems to be fairly clean, at least in this kind of way?
Oh, yeah, I think if you, you know, looked at the maybe the Obama emails from the 2012 campaign, you'd see the same sorts of things. Again, if you looked at the emails in the Romney campaign, I think you'd sign the same sorts of calculations. And I'm not saying it's a good thing, and that it's business as usual in Washington, and I can understand why voters are so upset.
On the Trump side, I mean, we're not talking about those kind of leaks or anything. Here we're talking about a guy that keeps taking to the microphone and saying the election is rigged. If I lose, it's because it's rigged. What's the deal? I mean, he's, you know, all of a sudden we're having a discussion in this country about, you know, rigged elections everywhere. It's almost as though he's trying to get something to happen on election day, and it doesn't make me comfortable.
Well, yeah, I think that's true. I think it's part of an effort, maybe laying the groundwork for an effort on Election Day to intimidate, you know, possible Democratic voters. I think the other part of this is I think he's making these allegations. One of the reasons he's making these allegations about rigged elections is that he's come to the conclusion that he's going to lose, and this is already made excuse for it. Well, I lost, but it wasn't a fair fight. They really didn't give me a chance. And I think Donald Trump is more concerned about his ego than anything else. And I think he's laying down an explanation for why he loses and why he may lose so badly.
So, and it's interesting because, of course, most candidates would never even be thinking about that. That's not what president. That's not, well, let me ask you, you're a strategist. My guess is that even when if you have a client who isn't looking good, that's not what's in their head, right? You've got to keep the positive fight attitude from up until the last second.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you know, candidates are always encouraging their people, you know, their base to turn out. And I think this could have hurt Trump because what he may be doing is telling his supporters, well, this election's rigged. It doesn't matter anyway. So he may be discouraging turnout from his own supporters.
We also hear, you know, you see reports on some of the cable networks of Trump supporters at rallies and basically, and you saw one at a Pence rally. Basically, she said, we have to call for a revolution. Now, I know these people are crazy, and I will say that they're nuts. But having said that, do you think we face anything like that? Or do you think once the election results are announced, if Hillary Clinton wins it, do the Trump supporters quiet down? Or do you think something underneath it is Trump actually trying to get there to
be something
not good?
Well, I wish I was wrong about this, but I think we're going to have continued ugliness. I think there are some people who do not, you know, won't accept the outcome of the election. And basically, Donald Trump is, you know, encouraging them to think that way. So I think there's going to be a lot of ugly and a lot of hostility after this election is over. I'm sorry to say that, but unfortunately, I think it will be.
And by the way, in fairness, because we get listeners from all sides listening to the podcast, so yes, it is true that Clinton supporters, I'm sure, have just people as crazy, since I'll use the words, I'll use them again, just as crazy, just as whatever on the Democrat side as they are, as they might be on the Trump side. But nobody should be incited. I don't care who wins, who loses, resorting to violence or anything like that. It's wrong, and I don't care what side you're on.
Well, absolutely. And, you know, I mean, we're an ugly period in American politics. I think it will get better eventually, but I don't think it's going to get better in the short term. It's very ugly. It's very disturbing, especially for people who've made their career, you know, their life's career in politics, who feel that, this, you know, the political system is being tarnished beyond recognition. And so, yeah, I think it's a very dark, ugly period. And the short term prospects, I fear, are that it won't get much better.
As a down ballot question, you know, typically if Clinton wins this thing and if she wins it in a Johnson-like landslide, don't know if that's going to happen, but if you looked at the map today, in the moment we speak, it looks like that could happen. If it did, then you would say, well, the Democrats are gaining control of everything. But there seems to be a movement afoot, Brad, in this country, which is, look, people seem to be adapting to the fact that Hillary will likely win, but but therefore let's keep Republicans in Congress and keep that difference between the two branches of government, almost keep that tension between the two branches of government. Do you see that happening?
I think, you know, that's a natural inclination in American politics. Americans are concerned about any one person in Washington getting too much power. So they try to balance a Democratic president with a Republican Congress, or a Republican president with a Democratic Congress. It basically keeps both parties honest. And right now, if you look at what the Republican candidates for Congress are doing, basically they've given up on Trump, and basically what they're saying is, hey, listen, you're going to need me to watch out for your interest when Hillary Clinton is president. That's basically the campaign a lot of vulnerable Republican members of Congress are running, is that Hillary Clinton's going to be president, so you need me to keep an eye out for her.
And just briefly and finally, of course, Mitch McConnell said, we're going to let the new president pick the Supreme Court justice. Sorry, Merrick Garland, but you're going to be out. And now, of course, that tune is changing with Senator John McCain, although he walked it back, but saying basically, I don't care who a President Hillary Clinton would put forth, we will block every nomination she sends. My point is, it sounds like 4 more years of gridlock.
Yeah, I think, you know, sadly, I think you're right, Paul. I think we are going to have gridlock, because my guess is what we're going to have is we may have a Democratic Senate, but I think it's likely that the Republicans maintain control of the House, which means if Hillary Clinton does become president, it's going to be very difficult for her, as difficult for her to get things through Congress as it's been for Barack Obama. So, yeah, I think we're into 4 more years of gridlock and stalemate.
But the Supreme Court, of course, tied into the Senate power. It's going to be very fascinating to watch which way that goes, because that may be more influential on the direction of this country than any other legislation she tries to put through.
And, you know, I mean, let's say the Democrats end up with a, small majority in the Senate. Maybe they have 51 votes or 52 votes. Even that, you really need 60 votes to get anything done
right
in the Senate because of the filibuster
that's
rule.
That's right.
So even if the House goes Democratic, Republicans essentially have a veto power, and I think they will maintain control of the House. So we're looking at gridlock.
And in not too long, Brad, we'll be having conversations about that, because one way or another, we'll know who wins this presidential contest and the contests around the country. Brad Bannon, a Democratic strategist, president of Bannon Communications Research. You know, I always love talking to you and always appreciate your insight. Thank you, my friend.
I love talking to you, Paul. Thank you.
Well, I could claim this next interview is a break from the politics that we talk about, but actually, if you put it in context in time, I'm not sure it is, because that is to say, we're talking about one of the most infamous people in Chicago history, maybe not in a good way, but politics, entertainment, all wrapped up in the life that this guy led. I'm tempting you, of course, by seeing if you can come up with the name of Al Capone. Yeah, Al Capone. There's been lots of biographies of Al Capone. I've read several of them, interviewed a lot of the authors, but this is a new book coming out on October 25th, and it's called Capone, His Life, Legacy, and Legend. And when I first saw this book, my first question is, what can you possibly tell me about Al Capone that we don't know or that we haven't read in some other biography? Well, that led me to talk with the author of this book. She's a National Book Award winner. She's written biographies on Saul Steinberg, Samuel Beckett. And so Deirdre Baer has written this book on Al Capone, but with a different twist to it, which we'll explain. Deirdre, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you.
So what is different about this book, as I learned, is it's who helped you with this. This wasn't you only sitting in a library or online these days, just trying to find whatever you could about Al Capone. You had some different help than other authors have had.
I certainly did. I had the cooperation of many members of Al Capone's family, his granddaughters and some of the children and grandchildren of his siblings, primarily his brothers.
And I'm guessing they were helpful to you. Had they been contacted by other authors before? Were you the first? Were they not willing to talk before? How did that all happen?
Well, they were unwilling to talk before I came along. They really have lived their lives in deep privacy. They've closely guarded their identities. Many of them changed their names. In fact, Al's brothers, during his lifetime, change their names. Only one of them, Ralph, retained the Capone name. So they were very private people. And when I started to write the book, it came about the way most of my books begin. I have an idea, or there's a question that I want to have answered for myself. And in this particular situation, a young man who was named Capone wanted to know the exact relationship of his family to Al Capone. And so one thing led to another. I talked to him. I talked to his family members. Other family members heard that I had been talking to people. They called me up. They sent me emails. And the next thing I knew, I had a very different kind of book. I'm supposed to be a literary biographer, so I had never really thought that I was going to be writing about the most famous American gangster.
And I have to tell you, as I was reading it, and it almost reads like a fiction book because it's not this dry biography. You've got lots of some uncomfortable details, although if people like watching The Sopranos or shows like that, you'll actually get your fill of that as you read this book. You know, I actually had no idea. I mean, I've read a lot about Al Capone, but I didn't, for example, Louis Armstrong, basically, making him play Joey Brown, the entertainer. You have to be a certain age to remember that name, but how they beat the crap out of him and they almost died. But I mean, you had to do what Capone wanted you to do, or you paid a price.
Oh, absolutely. People would say he had the most wonderful, magical smile, but be careful because he could turn on you in a moment and you'd be very sorry.
And there's one story, was it Joey Brown, where they were beating him up, but nevertheless Capone kind of took care of the medical bills, and pretty soon there were $1,000 bills going his way. I mean, he might hurt you, but he'll help you.
Exactly. In this instance, as he said about Joey Brown, who the reason for the big beating and all of that other trouble that happened to Brown, Capone said, if you had only remained in my employ, in other words, in my speakeasies, rather than trying to go to somebody else's speakeasies, this never would have happened. You should have come to me first. Now, and so that's how he was.
Yeah.
You know, I'll hurt you, but I'll help you.
I kind of wondered when Capone turned. I thought I'd read your book and see that he had, he had a Leave It to Beaver, upbringing, and then he just kind of turned later in his life or something. But that's not true. He got into trouble fairly early on.
Very early. He and all of his brothers turned to a life of crime very early. And their parents were such upstanding citizens.
Yeah.
And so it was kind of unusual that both boys turned to crime. But we have to consider the time and the place. This was Brooklyn around the turn of the century. And the Italians, as Jacob Riis, a great scholar, said, the Italians started at the bottom and they stayed there. And another man, a New York City government official, said, we have to bring the Italians in to do our dirty work because the Irish aren't going to do it anymore. And so the opportunities for Al Capone were, if not impossible, they were very limited. That's not to say that every Italian in New York at the turn of the century turned to a life of crime. We know that's not true.
Yeah, now I know you say his father died young in his 50s,
yeah.
But his mother lived on, and she just didn't kind of accept this image that her son Al had.
Well, as good Italian mothers did in that time and in that place, she had to be taken care of by her sons. She had no pension. She had no job. She had nothing she could do. And so the sons became, in effect, the patriarchs, the head of the family. And Al became the patriarch and the head of his family. And the mother and the wife and every other woman did what they were told.
I also love the story. We're not giving too much away. It's just that if you like what you're hearing, you'll want to read the book. The story of when he actually wanted to get arrested. I mean, he kind of knew there was too much heat, and he figured if he can kind of, maybe do some time, it would kind of take the heat off. So he and one of his partners arranged, at least this is what you write about, arranged a time where they would be caught for possession of guns, but they made sure that the guns were showing that they were going to get arrested. But then the prison time deal, didn't go as Capone expected it to.
Yeah, he thought he was going to be in Philadelphia in the Moyamensing prison for about 2 months, and it turned out he had to serve a little bit over a year. So, again, that didn't turn out the way he wanted. But, One of the most surprising things I found when I wrote this book, he was 25 years old when he took over the mob. And by the time he was 30, he was sick and broke and in jail. So that's 5 years. He was on top of the world for 5 years only. And after that, he was a broken man, and he died when he was 47. And yet today, all over the world, the name of Al Capone resonates. Everybody recognizes it.
And I guess I should ask, so much of this, I mean, you think a lot of it is folklore, but a lot of this is true. I mean, the St. Valentine's Day Massacre, you write about that. Capone always made sure, by the way, when events like that happened, he was nowhere to be found. You were not going to find him with a gun standing there. He was not going to have a gun on him, and he was going to be nowhere to be found, even though he was orchestrating.
Well, he learned that from the famous gangster Johnny Torrio, who in many ways was his mentor. And believe me, Johnny Torrio on his own deserves a full biography for somebody else to write, not me. But Johnny Torrio did that. He kept his hands clean, spotlessly clean. And Al Capone learned well from Johnny. And so, he was never around. Nothing was ever pinned on him. The only thing pinned on Al Capone was tax evasion.
That's right. They could never get him for any of the killings, but some would argue O.J. Simpson kind of paid a similar price, right? Whether or not he committed a murder, but that's not what he ever went to jail for.
Absolutely.
Yeah. But now, the other thing is, a lot of people, I mean, we all know Al Capone ended up in Alcatraz. Many of us have gone to Alcatraz. There's Al Capone's cell. One of the things I learned from your book was that that wasn't sort of a plan, that it was only because of the federal government, I think the attorney general, Alcatraz, they actually wanted to sort of have notorious people go to Alcatraz, and they went, hey, let's get Capone. I mean, how it happened was something I did not know.
Yeah, he was in the Atlanta Penitentiary, which at that time had the reputation of being the harshest and most brutal penitentiary in the country. And somebody got the idea that if we took an abandoned army base on an island in San Francisco and turned it into an impregnable prison, we could put the most dangerous people in the world there, and we could send a real message to all these criminal gangs all over the country. And so who, of course, was, the best person to put in such a prison but Al Capone? And off they took him to Alcatraz. He was already sick by that time. The syphilis that destroyed his brain had kicked in, and it was really quite a brutal episode in his life.
A lot of people think, I actually thought for a while he died at Alcatraz. He didn't die at Alcatraz. He actually ended his life outside of prison.
He died in his own bed in Miami, in his own house, with his wife beside him and all of his family there. He had a peaceful end, but a very early and untimely end. He was 47 years old when he died.
Did you learn anything about Al Capone that you didn't know or didn't suspect? I guess, what is the biggest surprise you learned that we read in the book that you're going, wow, even this is a shock to me?
Well, there were two of them, and the first I've already mentioned, which was how young he was when he took over the outfit and how very brief his reign of crime was. And the second thing was how deeply private all of his descendants were. I joke that I'm responsible for so many Capone family reunions because I actually introduced various cousins to each other who didn't even know that branch of a family existed. So that was quite a happy thing for me to be able to do.
So many years have passed. Do you think, I mean, if there's a Capone now, it's such folklore, it's such legend, and now that your work is done, do you think people should be afraid to have the Capone name? Or is it, I hate to say it, but is it almost kind of a cool thing to be, you're related to Al Capone, wow, let's chat?
Well, you have said it. The very young generation, the ones who are, I would say, between 20 and 30 right now, have said to their parents, wow, it is so cool that you are Al Capone's granddaughter or cousin or something like that. The older generation kind of shakes their head sadly and says, you don't know what we went through bearing that name or trying to persuade people that we did not bear that name. So it's a real generational thing. And, you know, right now we're so far removed from the really terribly bloody, angry years of the 1920s and all of those gang wars and those ridiculous prohibition laws, that we can laugh, we can accept the legend, and we can glamorize and dramatize Al Capone. But the reality was quite different. And the people who grew up with the name Capone, they didn't have an easy time of it.
Yeah, before I let you go, I have to ask you, you know, one of the questions I think a lot of people have is, he must have had so much money stashed away and hidden when he died. But, you know, he was sick. His mind was going. You address that in the book. So what are you willing to tell us? We'll go get the book, too. But what are you willing to tell us about the money that got stashed away, if any, when Capone actually died?
I'm willing to tell you that the reality was far different. And now you have to read the book to find out what that reality was.
Yeah. And you address that. You address his funeral. You address all that. It was just a treat to read, because you start with the Capones, the family coming to the United States and their work through Chicago. I mean, the truth is, why we got stuck with that image, I don't know, because certainly there's New York and there's Miami, and there's a lot of other places that could have claimed him, but we're the ones that have the image. But it's a fascinating read, and the book is called Capone, His Life, Legacy, and Legend. You can certainly pre-order it, but it will be out on October 25th, and since folks will be listening to this podcast even after October 25th, then it's readily available, and I encourage you to read it. It's really an interesting read. It is not dry. It was fun. I actually read it over a couple of days, and Deirdre Bear, congratulations on a great book and a great topic, and thanks for spending time with me.
And thank you.
Bye-bye now.
Bye.
Well, if you want to know more about what we've talked about here, follow me on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, at Paul Lisnek. That's PaulLisnek. And I'd love to hear your comments or topic suggestions for future podcasts. You can also go to my website, paullisnek.tv. And hey, don't forget to hit subscribe on WGN Plus and iTunes. And tune in each week to hear more Insider Scoop coming to you from behind the curtain.